It only requires a touch of a few buttons to receive it at home. Therefore, food packaging is a critical part of the production.
Over the last decade, there has been a great emphasis on developing packaging for the food industry. This is because Iran indigenized many machines needed to process and produce food items such as deli meats, beverages, pickles, and so much more. Proper packaging also increases shelf life, which is important for consumers. Previously, food items such as spices and dairy products were purchased bulk from customers abroad due to a lack of packaging. While exporting items in bulk has benefits, it's not as profitable as selling prepackaged foodstuff. So, in addition to adding value to raw products such as meat, companies have also designed attractive packaging to contain food in more manageable portions. Such a strategy increases not only product quality, but also food safety, which helps producers meet international export standards. This trend also helps companies with branding and has created job opportunities for designers.
As you probably already know, the food industry is heavily dependent on production in the agriculture sector. So it's no surprise that the agriculture sector holds the pulse of national food security and food exports. Plus, it is one of the only sectors that has been barely impacted by the US-imposed sanctions and the global coronavirus outbreak. That was horrible.
We looked at some figures from the Ministry of Agriculture to see how this sector is doing. Last year, around 6 million tons of agricultural and foodstuff products were exported. Trade of these products raked in roughly $4 billion. Pistachio, saffron, and confectionery products topped the export charts in value during that period. Other agriculture sectors, such as livestock, poultry, and aquaculture, have also generated millions of dollars in exports. Last year, nearly 450,000 tons of these items were sent to markets in neighboring regions, worth $500 million. Agriculture accounts for 8% of the country's gross domestic product. It might be interesting to know that around half of Iran's total non-oil trade comes from this sector. That's all based on data from Iran's Ministry of Agriculture. According to Iran's Customs Administration, the total non-oil trade value rose nearly 40% last year. Over 120 million tons of non-oil products worth $72 billion were traded with other countries in that period. Meanwhile, the government has implemented measures to encourage the development of agriculture. One trend this sector is witnessing is the application of smart technologies for the cultivation and harvest of various products. There has also been a boom in developing greenhouses and green practices to preserve natural resources. The word plastic was initially used to describe pliable and easily shaped objects. However, it only recently became a name for a category of materials called polymers. Such materials are abundant in nature. Take cellulose, for example. It's the material that makes up the cell walls of plants. However, synthetic polymers are a more recent invention of the last 150 years. These come from the plentiful carbon atoms found in fossil fuels. Since then, they have become an integral part of the industry, technology, and even various sciences.
We will explore Iran's plastic and polymer productions. We will also check out some of its downstream markets and their contributions to the national economy. These days, we use more plastic than ever before. It's terrible. So where does this material come from? And what goes into making this stuff? Let's find out.
Our quest for answers led us to a company specializing in making various polymer products. Parsa Polymer Sharif was established some 20 years ago and is a knowledge-based company that was born in the research department of the University of Sharif. As a leading advanced polymer compound manufacturer,
It makes various products essential to everyday living. It produces compounds based on commodity thermoplastic resins like PP, PE, and the famous PET, or PET. It also engineers resins like PVC and so much more. This knowledge-based company is a major supplier of raw materials to many industries. Some include original equipment manufacturers in the automotive market and PVC pipe producers in the construction industry. Over the years, this company has helped Iran save millions on products that would otherwise be imported. This firm has three main functions: research and development, innovation center, and production. It also has a brand new line for researching and producing biodegradable polymers for the packaging industry. Most of the raw materials needed for production are domestically purchased. When this stuff enters the company, it is first tested and graded based on its quality. Then, according to its intended use, the raw material is formulated and sent to machines for production.
Machines used in the polymer industry utilizes some of the most advanced machinery for production. The extruder is one of the most commonly used machines. They play a central role in plastic production. Extruder lines are the largest converters of plastics worldwide. Some of these machines can be domestically manufactured while others are still imported.
Its products are all tested in its well-equipped research and development lab. The various granules and resin compounds undergo over a dozen tests while being analyzed for quality here. Also, new product formulas are created in this highly technical research and development department. Through these facilities, the company is expanding its product portfolio. Products made here are produced along the lines of exports. So, national and international quality standards are implemented during the production processes. This means the quality of products found here doesn't just match international standards, they go beyond the quality of competing foreign brands in the international arena. The headquarters of this company is located in Sharif University Advanced Technologies Incubator. Owing to this, it has strong relations and collaborations with the scientific community. It has also been awarded for its contributions to the scientific and industrial sectors over the past years. This knowledge-based company also exports its products. The company has a unique future vision strongly intertwined with sustainable business development. This is partly due to its forward-thinking and social and environmental responsibility outlook.
Now, polymers are the primary materials that build many other products. Plastic items have different polymer formulations depending on their application. The majority of polymers made in Iran are domestically consumed. Some of its biggest customers are in the construction sector. Also, plastic is extensively used in the medical industry and transportation.
Almost everything around us is either made of plastic or has some plastic component. Moreover, plastic has played a central role in the development of the medical industry over the past 60 years. These materials are used to create hemodialysis machines, disposable needles, IV drips, and testing equipment vital to modern medicine. Plastics have also had a considerable impact on developing high-quality prosthetics. The National Medical Device Directorate estimates that Iran's share in the global medical device market will reach well over $7 billion in the next 3 years. PVC materials are also largely used in Iran's construction industry. For example, Iran's Doors and Windows Manufacturers Association estimates the domestic demand for PVC doors and windows is around 35,000 tons annually. This is partly due to the current residential construction boom in the country. The home appliance industry is also another mammoth customer of the polymer industry. Based on figures from the Ministry of Industry, Mining and Trade, Iran has doubled its production in this sector over the last 3 years. In 2021, around 15 million home appliance units were produced, with exports soaring to roughly $140 million. So, polymer production is key in expanding many manufacturing industries, which have raked in large amounts of foreign revenue for the country.
Many thanks for that wonderful report. Well, that brings us to the end of our show today. I've been Samson Sees. Sees you in the next bazaar.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us.
واقعیت زندگی
and try to apply them to our daily lives.
چجوری ممکنه؟
How is it possible?
از راه قرآن
by means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step brothers not the last one
هو الذی ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودین
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth that he may make it prevail over all religions though the polytheists should be averse.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد موسیقی خاصی دارد روش خاصی دارد
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones. But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran, Quran.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
The birthday of Muhammad, peace be upon him and his progeny, marks the greatest celebration in history, Imam Khamenei. All praise is due to Allah, the Lord of the worlds, and peace and greetings be upon our master Muhammad, upon his pure household, upon his chosen companions, and upon those who follow them until the day of judgment. I would like to congratulate you on the great birthday anniversary of the Holy Prophet of Islam. God's greetings be upon him and his household, and Hazrat Imam Ja'far Sadiq, God's greetings be upon him. This anniversary is as great as the birthday anniversary of the Holy Prophet. the value of this day and such other days should be appreciated. The Holy Prophet of Islam is the best and the highest human being created by God. The Holy Prophet is better, higher, and greater than all prophets, all saints, and all individuals in the world throughout history. He is superior to other prophets in terms of morality and nature, and he is peerless in terms of knowledge and generosity, and all of them beseech the Messenger of God to grant them a drop from his infinite sea and a drip of his boundless and immeasurable rain. The most important element of unity is the existence of Muhammad, peace be upon him. We say that the holy existence of the great Prophet and Messenger of Islam, sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam, is the most important point in creating unity. Our politicians, scientific and cultural personalities, writers, poets and artists should rely on this point, and all Muslims should get close to one another with this slogan. Muslims should take no heed of differences. They should not accuse and say takfiri things against one another, and they should not expel one another from religion. Hearts throughout the world of Islam are cheered with the love and remembrance of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam. All of us love that great personality. Besides, at an international level, the Holy Prophet is the link that connects the beliefs and the emotions of all Muslim peoples to one another. The Holy Prophet is the link that connects the beliefs and emotions of the Islamic Ummah, including all ethnicities with different denominations, to one another. Islamic unity is a sacred slogan. If the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam were among us today, he would invite us to promote unity, as this holy ayah says, "It grieves him that you should perish. Ardently anxious is he over you. To the believers is he the most kind and merciful." The Holy Quran, chapter 9, verse 128. He would prevent these kinds of discord. If we love the Holy Prophet, we should meet this major demand that he made.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. You've done
Good night to all our listeners. You are tuned into Iran Radio broadcasting from Tehran, and I'm your presenter for the next hour. We'll start this hour's lineup with Spotlight, a daily program which covers the most important events happening in the world today. And we round up this hour's programs with our varied radio productions feature. Stay with us for the next hour.
From Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marcia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Almost 2 years later, and after at least 65,000 people have been slaughtered, with many saying that number may be as high as 250,000 fatalities, the United Nations is finally calling the Israeli terror campaign in Gaza a genocide. Why now? Meanwhile, the Israeli Prime Minister says Israel is facing increasing pressure internationally and that the regime must rely on itself. Stay with us as we take a look at the swing of the pendulum away from the Zionist regime and what that may mean on this spotlight.
An unprecedented form of diplomatic pressure, legal action, and economic measures is isolating the Israeli regime on the world stage, with Prime Minister Netanyahu now acknowledging the crisis.
A media siege funded by massive amounts of money from Qatar and other countries like China. They are operating in the West, and no less so in the United States. The second part is more focused, and it is centered in Western European countries, through the activation of Muslim minorities there, who are becoming vocal, violent, and threatening the states. That's why we see this siege concentrating in Western Europe. As I said, arms shipments to us are being halted. This is happening now.
Netanyahu framed it as a necessity. But opposition leader Yair Lapid blasted the comments as a direct result of Netanyahu's flawed and failed policy. The pressure intensified dramatically with a report from United Nations investigators. They concluded Israel has perpetrated genocide in Gaza, deliberately targeting civilians.
The Commission finds it is genocide. In our report, the Commission found that the Israeli authorities and Israeli security forces committed and are continuing to commit the following underlying acts of genocide against the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip.
The report implicates senior officials, including Netanyahu and others, for inciting genocidal acts. The findings have been submitted to the International Criminal Court. Global response to Israeli crimes is escalating. Countries like the UK, France, and Canada to formally recognize a Palestinian state. Belgium has banned imports from illegal settlements. Spain has imposed a partial arms ban. And Persian Gulf states are urging a reconsideration of ties with Israel. Israel relies heavily on the unwavering support from the United States, which protects it from severe repercussions. However, this support contrasts with a genocide that has no clear end game or tangible results beyond devastation. Hamas remains undefeated, and there is no political solution to the Gaza war. So, where is Israel going? The regime is at a crossroads facing unprecedented global condemnation and stuck in a costly war with no viable exit strategy. The pressing question is no longer just about military victory, but about how Israel navigates its rapidly diminishing standing in the world and what kind of future it can secure for itself.
I'd like to welcome my guests to this program. Out of Beirut, author and researcher Daniel Yekic. And out of London, activist and political analyst Batu Sobeti. Well, thanks so much for being with us. Let me start this off with Daniel. I mean, the indiscriminate bombings, killings, and targeting of infrastructure by Israel was actually initiated from the very beginning of its onslaught on Gaza. So what happened? What is different right now that the UN decided to now call this a genocide?
That's a very good question, because even if we look at the confirmation by the UN today that the Israeli violence and crimes against humanity in fact constitute a genocide, even this is too little too late. It is, of course, good that there is this acknowledgement and documented. But Palestinians, Palestinian voices and sources that are generally marginalized, not only in the public discourse, but in the international community as such, have been documenting the genocide for so long before October 7, because the entire colonial project as such is a genocidal. What has changed today, if we look at the development in the last 23 months since October 7, is that the global pressure against the Israeli regime is unprecedented, and it is impossible to ignore the human rights violations and the ongoing genocide, given the global pressure, given the protests among average citizens around the world in major cities, including in Western cities, and as a result, the pressure on Western governments for their complicity on the one hand, and of course, their lack of action, and of course, the general frustration with the international institutions, the international community, and in particular, of course, also the UN and its institutions, which have shown a severe failure to intervene in this ongoing genocide. So even this acknowledgement today that there is a genocide is stating very much the obvious after at least 2 years of the Israeli regime live streaming its genocide and frankly bragging about it, if we look at the political communication from that regime. So on the one hand, it is unprecedented that we see this global calling out of the Israeli regime, but again, given the imbalance of power structures worldwide, it is still too little too late. And the other question, of course, what can be done as a consequence to intervene and to help Palestinians who continue to be massacred as we speak this very moment?
Right. Well, staying with you, Daniel, I mean, you just mentioned about the global awareness. So how big of a part has that played in it all? And what does that mean? Does it mean that the UN, if there was not this increased pressure, and there has been from the global community for a while now, that basically they would continue to ignore this? Because at the same time, as we've been saying, it still has taken 2 years to happen.
Exactly. And I think one of the reasons is, of course, the pressure among regular citizens, among activists, also to some, to a smaller extent, some media, even among the powerful global media that has shed light to some extent, again, but still in a very biased way, oftentimes against Palestinians, and the complicity, I think, of the international community, because what has happened in the past 2 years is that the Israeli regime has created a lawless world that we live in, where it stands above the law, it stands outside of international law, which puts into question the very existence of the UN, the existence of international law, if there are no mechanisms that can enforce any consequences or sanctions against regimes that commit genocide. So obviously, whatever is happening in Gaza today is something that can also expand and happen elsewhere, because that's the damage that the Israeli regime has done to humanity. But even within the UN, if we look at the political communication, oftentimes we still hear the very powerful dominant rhetoric about the so-called two-state solution, about the so-called diplomatic recognition, and oftentimes viewing the situation in Palestine as if it were a conflict, quote-unquote, between two countries and not a genocide. So I think what is very important here is that the language has changed, that less euphemism and sugarcoating is used to actually refer and to state the obvious, which is a genocide, and which affects, of course, also humanity beyond Palestine.
Indeed. Well, Batul, do you think that it would have taken the UN 2 years to declare this a genocide if, for example, this was happening in Ukraine and Russia was the culprit? Okay, unfortunately, it seems that we have some difficulties establishing that line. I'm going to throw that back to you, Daniel. Your thoughts on that same question. Would it be the same if this was happening, what we've been witnessing now for 2 years, this genocide in Gaza, if it was happening in Ukraine and Russia was the culprit, would it take the UN 2 years to determine that this is a genocide? I mean, how do you see it?
Of course not. Obviously, because of the Western interest, if we look at, as you pointed out, I mean, Ukraine, that's another war that has been receiving a lot of media and political attention in the last 2 years, which is a proxy war that is being fought by NATO and by the European Union on behalf of their weapons industry and their economic interests, where sometimes the political focus and the rhetoric is focusing on the Ukrainians, but very much Ukraine is being abused by the West in this case for its own goals. And Russia, of course, in this case, is which is identified as the aggressor, is a major or considered a threat to some extent by Europe, by other Western powers. And so given those power relations and the intentions towards Russia from the West, which are in this case to contain Russia, to decrease its power and influence, would have obviously led to a very different framing. I think we even see that the situation in Ukraine is even sometimes compared to Palestine, which of course, I mean, it is horrible, any war in which civilians are killed. But even here, there is an entire history of a century of genocidal colonialism in Palestine that is still being very much upheld by the West. So I think the power imbalance and, of course, the centrality of the military-industrial complex of NATO and, of course, the Western world very much shapes the way in which wars are framed. We can even look at throughout the region of Western Asia. Syria is another example where the West.
Stay with me, Daniel. Sorry to interrupt you, but hopefully we've established that connection with Batul now. Thanks so much, Batu, for being with us, and sorry about the technical issues. I mean, your thoughts, what does it mean? Now that the UN has declared this a genocide, so what? Now, what's going to happen? Which measures can this organization now take against the Israeli regime?
Right. Thanks for having me, Marzia. The UN, as we know, since its inception, its resolutions don't get enacted. So, for example, the resolution that, you know, the Palestinians have the right to return, or the annexation of the West Bank and the occupation of Gaza in 1967 is illegal. At the end of the day, this is more of a moral declaration, but practically speaking, on the ground, it means nothing, because we know the decisions of the UN means nothing. Why? Because the UN as an institution was created post-World War II by the victors of the war, which was chiefly America at the time. So there's really no means or mechanisms of implementation when it comes to the UN, because we know that these decisions also, all these resolutions that come out, are not a part of the Security Council where it's like binding. But what it is you've got the majority of the countries now recognize this to be a reality, with pressure from the majority of the public, which has turned into this general perception, which they have no choice but to acknowledge. But we know that it's the West that ultimately controls the UN when it comes to decision-making, because the UN is driven by America more than anything else. Ultimately, we have reached this level because of the accumulation. It's reached a boiling point. The situation has become unbearable and exposed to a level that is unacceptable by any degree. And once it reaches this stage, the UN has to take some kind of stance. Some things can be withstood, others can't. But when they want to finish Gaza in front of the bare eyes of the world, and they reach this level of not caring about anything, the entity is completely unleashed and untamed, which, may I add, is a point of complete weakness and not strength for Israel to act like this. For it to break all international resolutions and agreements and to hit and strike whenever and whatever, Israel considers that it's able to do this because it's going through an existential crisis. For that reason, it considers that it has a free hand to break every law because there's something much bigger at stake, and that's its very existence. And as a result, we see the complete destruction of Gaza, South Lebanon. We see it going after any entity that it considers a danger in any country, whether it's Qatar or elsewhere. But the strong entity, if Israel was strong, it wouldn't have had to resort to such measures. And this real crisis is that if it remains in its current state, Israel will come to an end. And Israel knows this. And as a result, Israel has two choices in front of it. Either it expands by all means, or if it doesn't resort to expansionism, which it's trying, it will ultimately shrink. And it will end, because if it's not able to expand in a way that guarantees its existence. So for this reason, we see that Israel uses all means to establish itself. But the reality on the ground indicates that only in Syria has it really managed to actually gain some occupation, because there was really no resistance. But it's been really failures in all other fronts.
Well, staying with you, Batul, with what you've just mentioned about Israel feels that it's an existential situation that it has. So now that Netanyahu, now he said that basically the world is against them, they're isolated, and they have to depend on themselves. So let's break this down and exactly what that means and what he is trying to say to the world. It almost seems that, well, could it be that this is actually a threat and just saying where they're going to go from here? And not really that they cared before what various organizations or countries would say, but now saying we're going to do it all ourselves, and basically we don't care what anyone says or what anyone tries to do. I mean, your thoughts about that?
Absolutely. I mean, that is Israel's modus operandi, except it's really showing itself right now, and it's really exposed because of the level of existentialism that it is going through, which means it's so careless and will do anything, to the point where it doesn't care what Trump or any other entity for that matter even has to tell it. It's like, we either do what we need to do or we'll die, basically. That's the way that it sees it. So all transgressions against all agreements is an indication of the extent of the weakness and not the strength, because Israel's faced with two choices: either it expands or it shrinks. And Israel is exposed to the point where it cannot continue, because it strives to achieve whatever result it wants, but such results that it wants, it's not achieving on the ground. And the more Israel transgresses, the more it is becoming exposed in its nature. But we know that Israel breathes through the West, and one of the biggest weaknesses of Israel is that it's so dependent on the external. But when it reaches the point where we see in America and all other nature, and in all other nations, it's so exposed, and the roots of its existence has now come into question by the people. It's like, how much more time does it need for this generation, the majority of which believe in the West, that Israel has no right to exist and see the ugliness of this entity? By continuity, these lobbies that exist in the West will not continue, because the people are moving. We see those movements in countries like Spain, in Ireland. Even in European meetings today, they're speaking about sanctions, or even just the fact that they're speaking in the direction of acknowledging the Palestinian statehood gives an indication that these countries consider that they have to take into account public opinion. And this can be developed to the point where Israel becomes a pariah on all fronts. And Herzog himself, the Israeli president, came out and said, you know, this is a serious threat for us. Of course, for someone like Netanyahu to make that declaration, at the end of the day, Netanyahu only wants to save his own existence. He's not really thinking what is in the best interests of Israel, which is why someone like the former PM Olmert would come out and say, actually, Israel's committing war crimes. He's saying Israel's committing war crimes because he recognizes that really it is the real end of Israel that the world recognizes it as a pariah, and we cannot go in that direction. But for someone like Netanyahu, he's not really thinking what is in the best interests of the Israeli occupation entity, because the war in Lebanon, the expanded war in Lebanon, the continued war in Gaza going on for 2 years, none of that is really in the interests of Israel. As a society, we know that it is riddled with contradictions. You know, it's enough to see, especially during the war in Iran, the extent of the Israelis that fled from the country, You had over 30,000 Israelis that were just urgently trying to get off on boats mm-hmm. off to Cyprus illegally as a result of that. And just the Israelis feel unsafe okay. as a society as a whole.
Well, let me look at that, Daniel, with the Israelis feeling unsafe. I mean, it has been behaving already like a rabid dog. But, I mean, do you think that basically we're just going to see it become even more extreme because it feels that it has no choice?
Definitely, because the Israeli regime, the entity as such, is built on this very existential contradiction where, on the one hand, it can only exist through perpetual violence because it is an artificially implanted settler colony that is inhabited by settlers who came from other parts of the world to live on stolen Palestinian land, on Palestinian mass graves in Palestinian houses. And so one of the failures in the entire Israeli colonial project is the lack of the settlers' connection to the land. And as the other speaker mentioned, if we just look at the reactions on when Iran defended itself against the U.S.-Israeli attack against Iran, how many settlers were fleeing Palestine? And they were fleeing because either they have a second citizenship, they have somewhere else to go, because they are not from Palestine. So this is one of the major weaknesses here. This is a colony that is trying to exterminate at the same time people who live on their land and who are fighting for their survival, which is also why if we have to have a comparison here, we can very much say that, you know, Palestinians, Lebanese, anyone in the region who stands in the way of this genocidal settler colonial conquest is fighting for their survival on their own land while the Israeli regime is spreading death and destruction. And in order for it to survive, it needs to spread more death and destruction, again with apartheid and ethnic cleansing being systematic components of this regime, which is now of course completely out of control, stands above international law for the entire world to see. And the consequence of this is for settlers, of course, to feel less safe. And why should a settler feel safe when they are occupying someone else's land and trying to exterminate that population? So a lot of, I think, the decline of the Israeli regime and of the settler society also happens from within. And another reminder of how grave that internal situation within the colony is of course the military censorship. We remember again the Iranian response to the Israeli attacks and how settlers were not allowed to use social media or to post pictures or videos of the damage that has been a consequence of the Iranian response, because and I would like to cite again Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, who said at the liberation of Lebanon that the entity is weaker than a spider's web. I think that moment is becoming much more transparent as all of this aggression reaches a culmination, but also shows the very how fragile this artificial genocidal entity really is.
Right. Well, Batul, I mean, we've seen, as you mentioned, that more and more countries are actually saying that they support a Palestinian state. We're seeing on an international level also more support for Palestine and anti-Israeli sentiment. But at the same time, the genocide continues. Palestinians are still being killed and bombed. So do you think that this basically gives an example or sets for the Palestinians that basically there's nothing else that they can do but resist, because not the international so-called community or organizations nor negotiations, at the end of the day, the resistance has to be or is the only way that it can go forward and basically bring this to an end? I mean, how do you see it?
Yes, all of these tools that we've mentioned and these means, the UN and what branches of the UN, the international courts, they're all very all the organizations that belong to the UN, in actual retrospect, belong to the American and the Western decision. And it is hinged on America that this war is continuing, because it's America that's giving Israel the complete a free hand. So it's unexpected for us to have any expectation for results that will come out of it. Yes, Palestinians for a long time have reached this very conclusion that you are mentioning, and that is that resistance is the only way. Until now, we see it stands as a miracle that Palestinians are resisting, are not complaining about the resistance. The Palestinians in the West Bank understand that resistance is the only means. The Gazawis, we never hear them blame the resistance. We never hear them talk about even October the 7th in a way in which, why did this come upon us? No nation in the world has been tested under such brutal circumstances as the Palestinians in Gaza, and it continues to resist. And that is the cornerstone in which all other actions are built on. Resistance is the cornerstone. Everything else becomes an add-on, but that's the foundation, yes.
And on that note, thank you both for being with me. Daniel Yekic, author and researcher out of Beirut, Beitou Sobeiti, activist and political analyst out of London. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Israel is committing a live-stream genocide, yet Israeli sporting teams and players have not been declared global pariahs. They continue to participate in club and international competitions with the full backing of governing bodies. As bodies are bloodied, starved, and martyred in Gaza by the IOF, Israeli teams attempt to whitewash their genocide. Nowhere is this starker than in the world's global sport, football. Calls to FIFA and UEFA, the sports governing bodies, have fallen on deaf ears despite public revulsion at Israeli actions. But Israeli teams may soon be shown the red card. A brand new initiative aims to target those at the very heart of football and bring about a revolution through sports. Leading the campaign is Ashish Prashar. He is a former Middle East peace envoy advisor, political strategist, and speaker. Thank you very much, Ashish, for joining us today to speak about this. Why football? You know, why are you trying to address the genocide through sports and specifically through football?
Well, there's a saying that there should be no normalization in abnormal times. And what is more normal than people playing football, right? We think about how that brings people together culturally, through, you know, fans, through games, through moments in life. And it's really important that if a state is committing a genocide, that it has no place in that. You know, the if you look at the big impact from the South African apartheid timeline, the sports boycott had a pivotal impact on them dismantling the apartheid regime. And it's because it was isolation. But also, moreover, sport connects with everybody. Unlike any other cultural thing like art or music, pretty much everybody engages in what they would call the Colosseum in every way, right? Yeah. And no other sport is bigger than football. Yeah. And with football, you trigger all the other sports, right? You know, if football goes, the Olympics go. If football goes, all the other sports follow. And that isolates this genocidal entity. And that's why it's so important that we follow this path.
Absolutely, and I think, you know, amazing to see how different countries, different cultures, you know, when we talk of the big football clubs, how, you know, there's such attachment in different parts of the world. Ashish, tell us about the initiative itself. You know, what is it about and what are you trying to really achieve?
Well, look, you said it yourself in the opening. FIFA and UEFA have ignored calls to throw Israel out of football for 2 years. I mean, it even goes longer. You know, Israel's been sportswashing their crimes through sport and culture for decades, right? Campaigns have been running for decades to kick them out of football. They failed. I mean, they've raised awareness, but the reality is you have an immoral being in at the top of FIFA who's best friends with Donald Trump right now. The idea that he is individually going to throw Israel out, I think, is a non-starter. So we have to think of different, more radical tactics, right? And there's a saying, the Black Panthers, like, use some radical imagination. We know we can't get the top. Israel's also invested heavily in protecting their place at FIFA's table. So where do we go? We follow something that just happened in recent history. When Russia was thrown out of football, they weren't thrown out because FIFA and UEFA have morals. In fact, the only consistent thing here is the head of FIFA has no morals and he doesn't care if white children or brown children are being killed. He kicked them out because on the second day of the invasion, 12 European countries led by Sweden and Poland boycotted Russia. They wouldn't play the Russian national team. They wouldn't play their club teams. And for that reason, they forced UEFA and FIFA to suspend Russia because football couldn't continue. It actually impacted the integrity of the game. Mm-hmm. And we are following that same model. We are starting a coordinated campaign to target European football federations and, moreover, the heads of European football federations. So we are asking the public to flood those football federations, protest them daily, protest the chief execs and presidents of those. Because here's the other kicker. Most chief execs and presidents of football federations have executive power, meaning they can actually just boycott a nation, club, or a player if they deem it's the right decision. So that's individuals really, yeah, have this power, yeah. And I want to make that really clear.
Yeah.
You can target someone who is an accessible person in your country and demand they take action to get these genocidal players out of your country, get that genocidal team never step foot on your pitch, and make sure that genocidal state is not normalized anymore in your country. So you should be going out there to demand your federation acts.
Which is quite surprising, I mean, at least for me, you know, countries, for example, like Spain, where we've seen a lot of pro-Palestinian, you know, movements and things happening, yet we haven't seen anything from football. I mean, does it surprise you?
I mean, it doesn't, right? There's a lot of money in football, and I'm sure that's played a massive role in this, and I'm sure there's lots of pressure coming down from FIFA on federations not to do anything. But also, I think actually the bigger reason is nobody knows they can do this. Okay. You know, how many people actually knew that there was a boycott of Russia before the FIFA suspension? These federation heads, including in nations like Ireland, Norway, and Spain, who are supposedly Palestinian allies, they get away with the fact that nobody knows they can do this. Most football fans don't know they can do this. Most footballers don't know they can do this. I've talked to many people in the football space who didn't realize that that's what caused the suspension of Russia. Yeah. And these people are experts. And they were like, oh, I didn't realize that. And that is the most powerful thing here. Now, we are tired of protesting and nobody listening, right? Gianni Infantino is the same as Trump or Starmer. He's sitting in neon Switzerland, doesn't care that we sit in stands. Mm-hmm. In fact, he even made a point of moving his North American headquarters to Trump Tower. If you ever wanted a sign that he doesn't care about our protests, he stuck his flag in the ground and said, this is where I stand. So what do? We go after accessible targets, people in our countries that actually might have said they care about Palestinians in some cases, especially at a government level. In societal level, I think everyone in Europe we targeted is on our side. We are the people, and we have actual power here to make sure that they know that we will not let it be unknown that they've been sportswashing genocide this entire time. So as we launch this campaign, everyone's name will be public who has this power in each football federation. And like I said, we demand that they act to boycott Israel, because there's no way this genocidal entity, who now it's been declared by the UN that it is a genocide, should continue to participate on the pitches of Europe.
So apart from fans, which I believe are the ones you're targeting, you know, who else are you mobilizing? And how would you suggest people support the campaign?
People of conscience. This is not a, like, hey, you have to be a football fan. By the way, I think everybody, in a weird way, it's like I said, it's the only global game, right? Everybody kind of watches it to a degree. But it's people of conscience. Like, I don't really believe that there's any difference between a football fan, a union member, a political strategist or whatever, right? This is an opportunity to actually knock one of the core pillars out from the Israeli regime. This is an opportunity to knock the culture pillar out. And then the economic pillar falls too. Isolation causes more isolation, right? If we keep going down this path, we knock this one. By the way, this is an easy win. If we sustain pressure on these football federation heads, everywhere they go, not just at the federation building, their homes, their schools, this is important because they, at this point, are complicit. The heads of federations in Italy, France, Spain, Ireland are complicit because they have known for the last 2 years they can act. And if they claim solidarity with Palestine, they've done nothing to show it. Norway recently said they will play the game with Israel and donate the funds to Gaza. I mean, yes, Norway, an allied nation, and their head of the federation wears a kefir, but she knows deep down she can boycott Israel. Like, and the reason we're doing this simultaneously here, because I want to be a realist about this, because, yes, I've said that about Norway, but Norway are not going to give up their World Cup place, right? But the reason we're doing it across Europe at the same time is so they provide each other cover. Yeah. So you did this once as 12 nations. Do it again as 12 nations, or 9 nations, or 8 nations, or however many of you decide to do it together. Because I guarantee you, UEFA and FIFA are not going to punish all of you as a collective. Could you imagine an environment where they throw Spain, the number one team in football, out of a World Cup for Israel?
Absolutely. I think, you know, the collective part of it, I think, is the most effective, you know, strategy. But what would you suggest, you know, people who are listening probably and thinking, you know, I want to support this initiative. How do they put pressure? What do they do?
Obviously, the easy tools to use are right, emailing the federation heads, calling the federation offices, making sure your demands are met. But organize, organize, organize. They are scared of you. There's a French saying, nous sommes le pouvoir, we are the power. Came out of the 70s and the 60s when the unions took control of the countries. You are powerful beyond measure. And we need to organize things every day. Don't just rely on football fans and the ultras that have been organizing the first wave of protests. Palestinian movement should be targeting them. This is a win. We're always saying, how can we win? What are we going to do to make a change immediately? Right? They can make this decision tomorrow. Yeah. They don't need a vote. They don't need to consult. They don't need to do anything. Apply pressure every day till they break. And Israel will not be playing those international games in October against Italy and Norway. Israeli club teams will not play in European competitions, and Israeli players will be banned from stepping foot in Europe. But it only works if you apply pressure. They are scared of you, and they know you mobilized. You mobilized at a target that is accessible. Not prime ministers and presidents sits behind gates that don't care that what we say on the street